From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air for Mother's Day, we have stories of mothers from mothers, daughters, and sons. We'll hear from novelist Amy Tan, poet Allen Ginsberg, film director Paul Mazursky, country music star Merle Haggard, novelist Rob Forman-Dew, and more. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Crimson Tide, a new thriller starring Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington. That's all coming up on today's archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Dr. Jack Kevorkian has presided over the suicide for the second time this week. This time, police found the body of a young man in the back of Kevorkian's 1968 Volkswagen van, which was parked next to a county jail. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
Kevorkian's attorney says his client was present today as 27-year-old Nicholas John Loving took his own life. He would not comment on the cause of death, but the attorney did say the suicide did not take place in Kevorkian's van. He said the vehicle, with the body in back, was driven to the jail to make it easier for police and the medical examiner. Nicholas Loving, who traveled to Michigan from his home in Phoenix, Arizona, suffered from an advanced case of Lou Gehrig's disease. In addition to Kevorkian, Loving's mother was present today. On Monday of this week, Kevorkian was also on hand when an elderly minister with lung disease died from carbon monoxide poisoning. It's possible that the doctor will face criminal charges in both of these cases because the U.S. Supreme Court has refused to hear his appeal of a state ruling that there's no constitutional right to assisted suicide. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Democrats blasted Republican budget plans today, saying the GOP is out of step with the values of the American people. Vice President Al Gore says the administration will not join the budget debate until a proposed tax cut is off the table. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
House and Senate Republicans unveiled their plans this week to bring the federal government's budget into balance over a 7-year period. The plans rely heavily on savings from social programs such as Medicare and Medicaid, which provide health insurance for the elderly and the poor. Democrats oppose many of the proposed reductions, but Vice President Al Gore and Democratic leaders said today they would not engage in a bipartisan exercise to balance the budget until Republicans took a tax cut, reductions in education and Medicare off the table.
We do not accept an approach that slashes Medicare and guts education and raises taxes on working people to finance a tax cut for the very wealthy.
As is the custom in the budget debate, Republicans are now challenging Democrats to either support the plan or come up with an alternative. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The government says consumer prices increased 0.4% last month. The jump was led by higher food prices, which increased at their fastest pace in 5 years. Fruit and vegetable prices were up sharply, especially in the wake of severe California flooding. Lettuce prices rose more than 100%. The core rate of inflation, which excludes volatile food and energy prices, also rose 0.4%. But several economists believe that a slowing economy will keep inflation in check this year. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up almost 14 points at 4,425. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Angry Cuban Americans are continuing to protest the new policy of repatriating Cuban refugees. Two women disrupted commencement ceremonies at the University of Miami today. Officials were bestowing an honorary degree on the head of the Organization of American States, Cesar Gaviria. The women took over the stage for a short time before being escorted away. Meanwhile, Cuban exile leaders stood across the street from the ceremony and criticized Gaviria for supporting Cuba's inclusion in the OAS. Cuban Americans say they plan more civil disobedience in major cities until the Clinton administration's policy of repatriating Cubans is changed. United Nations Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali says the UN needs to conduct a fundamental review of its peacekeeping mission in Bosnia. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Mr. Boutros-Ghali met in Paris today with his top military and civilian advisors in the former Yugoslavia. According to a UN statement, they discussed the deteriorating situations both in Bosnia, where Serbs have been tightening their siege of Sarajevo, and in Croatia, where the government recently captured a rebel Serb stronghold. Due to increasing attacks against UN peacekeepers, said the statement, Boutros Ghali has decided that, quote, a fundamental review of the UN Protection Force's role was required. Several French peacekeepers have been killed or wounded in Sarajevo recently, increasing pressure on the French government to withdraw its large force from Bosnia. And all peacekeepers were reminded by their commander today that they may respond with vigorous force when attacked. I'm Andy Bowers in London.
FBI Director Louis Free says members of right-wing militia groups have made death threats against some federal agents. Free says that's prompted him to relocate some people. He's told Congress some groups have put up wanted posters that include agents' home addresses. Militias have come under close scrutiny since the April 19th bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I think it's impossible to find a Mother's Day card that could come close to describing how you feel about your mother. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear some pretty complicated feelings expressed about mothers. Mothers who tried to save their children from trouble, and mothers who made trouble for their children. Mother's Day cards never praise the mother for being overprotective. Maybe it's just a difficult word to rhyme. Here's comic Jimmy Tingle on his mother. He was our guest in 1990.
I'm 8 years old, playing in the front yard. My mother comes running out of the house. Oswald's been shot! Oswald's been shot! Kids, get in the house! I could never figure that out. I mean, what was going through my mother's mind? What does she think, that Jack Ruby was sitting in a cell in Dallas, Texas, going, all right, Oswald got Kennedy. I got Oswald. But there'll be no peace in this land until the Tingle kids are dead.
Did this actually happen to you, that your mother called you inside?
Right.
Was your mother protective? did she not let you do things other kids' mothers let them do?
Oh, no. My mother was pretty cool, actually. She wasn't overly protective. No, I mean, you know, to a certain extent. You know, we had to come home, you know. You know, every night we had to be in, you know. Oh, real mama's boy. Ah, sleeping in your bed again, were you? Yeah. No, but she was cool. I mean, you know, I'm pretty much the all-American boy, you know?
Comic Jimmy Tingle recorded in 1990. Paul Mazursky paid homage to his domineering mother in the film Next Stop Greenwich Village. Mazursky also directed An Unmarried Woman, Moscow on the Hudson, Down and Out in Beverly Hills, Moon Over Parador, and Enemies, a Love Story. In Next Stop Greenwich Village, the mother was played by Shelley Winters.
Did you have a Shelley Winters kind of mother?
I did. I was thinking this morning, as a matter of fact, when I was sitting in a steam room in a hotel, of a book that I might write someday, because maybe the time is coming close. And I was thinking of chapters, and they would all be names of the people that were influential in my life. And the first one, of course, would be Jean, who was my mother.
I don't know if your mother's still alive, but...
No, she's not.
Did she live to see any of your movies?
She saw Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. She was at the opening in New York at the New York Film Festival.
Great, the one about sex, perfect.
About sex, and she sat there with me and Natalie Wood and my wife and Bob Culp and Elliot Gould and Diane Cannon and Mayor Lindsay. When it was over, she said to me, "Oh, so don't be such a big shot." That was my mother's, you know what I mean?
I sure do, yeah.
I mean, she was powerful and funny, and I had a lot of trouble with her. But she was definitely, I would guess, that, you know, the source of my pain and inspiration at the same time with the movies. But I now that it's all so many years ago, think about it with great affection. At the time, I was afraid of her. I really was.
It hard to leave her and to go to the West Coast?
That was a relief.
Mm-hmm.
The West Coast was, oh, boy, I did it. I'm free. But she soon found her way out there.
Oh, really?
And then she said to me, "I don't like it. It's a lot of palm trees." And she went back. She didn't want to stay there.
Huh.
Director Paul Mazursky recorded in 1991.
Everyone complains when they think their mother is overprotective, but of course we know mothers have good reason to worry about their children. Novelist Rob Foreman Du recently wrote a memoir called The Family Heart. She says that when she thinks her children may be in jeopardy, she turns to certain rituals and superstitions. So do some of her friends. For instance, one of her friends worries about her child traveling. So when her son is on a plane returning from a visit with his father on the opposite coast, here's what she does.
She scrubs her entire house. And I know just exactly she's
What's the point of scrubbing the house?
Well, if she has any fun while her children are in the air, I know she feels that she that somehow they'll take her children away from that they will the plane will crash because how dare she have fun while her children are in jeopardy. Now her children are getting older too. All of us do this. I'm sort of starting to grow out of it.
What do you do?
Well, what I do is wear my opal earrings, which I have on right now, actually. Because one of my children is traveling right now. They're really not even pretty. But my children gave... I was born in October, so opals are lucky for October. I mean, of course they're not lucky. It's a superstition, but... And of course I'm not superstitious, but I'm wearing these opals. I wear these whenever... I've sort of extended it now. It's not just my children. Anybody I love or care about who's traveling, I put on these opal earrings, which when a friend of mine recently flew to Australia was really painful because they're not comfortable to sleep in. But they work. The planes haven't crashed. So I should knock wood now.
Right? So you have to sleep in them too, how to make this work.
Yes, you can't let yourself off the hook. If you're going to be superstitious, you've got to sort of follow through with it. But of course, I mean, we all know, all of the parents, my friend who's scrubbing her garbage cans with bleach knows that, on some level, because she's a brilliant woman, she knows that that is not going to keep this plane in the air. But on the other hand, she's not going to take any chances.
Writer Rob Foreman Du recorded last year, "It's amazing what a mother can do to save a child in jeopardy." Writer Gary Paulson is best known for his adventure books for young people. A few years ago, we invited him to read a passage about his mother from his memoir, Eastern Sun, Winter Moon. This is about a traumatic experience from his childhood, and the language he uses reflects the fear and horror of the moment, so listener discretion is advised.
Mother and I spent the war years in Chicago. My father was on Patton staff and left with him in 1939, just after I was born, to train and then to fight in Africa and Europe, and I did not see him to know him again until I was 7 years old. Mother worked at a munitions factory on swing shift, where she ran a machine that made belted 20-millimeter ammunition. At first, when we went to Chicago and she worked, she would stay home on the weekends when she didn't have to be at the factory. We were alone a lot then, and she made me take naps in the afternoon with her, which I hated, but she made me take anyway. And on one afternoon, I was supposed to be napping, I found part of Mother I had never seen but would never forget. I'd grown some while, even that young, and had devised a way to sneak off. I would pretend to go to sleep, lying next to her in the bed, and when I did that, she would doze off herself. These were warm summer afternoons in an unair-conditioned apartment, and the hot air off the street blew the cheap curtains in small puffs, and dozing came very naturally for her after the hard work of the week. As soon as I sensed her going to sleep, I would begin to slide toward the bottom of the bed an inch at a time until I made it to the foot of the bed and then carefully, so carefully, to the floor. Freedom. If I remained quiet, she might sleep for an hour or more, and I could play and enjoy myself. I didn't often do anything wrong. Played with toys on the kitchen floor where the pattern of the linoleum made lines that could become roads for my small metal cars and trucks and war toys. But sometimes rather other opportunities presented themselves. On one afternoon, I was successful and had begun to play when I saw that the apartment door was open a bit. I decided to go outside. I grabbed my stuffed dog with one eye and dragged it bumping down the back stairs and out into the alley. It was a wonderful, mysterious, and forbidden world, the alley. I was allowed to play outside only when supervised or when Mother was awake, and now I seemed to be off on some great adventure. Near the apartment was a billboard with a large pack of Lucky Strikes and the green pack facing out to the street. The billboard angled back toward the apartment, and where it ran into the wall, it made a hidden, darkened corner. I no sooner made the area next to the billboard when I had to pee, and I went back into the corner so nobody would see me. I set dog on the ground and was busy taking care of the problem when I sensed a dark shape looming in the opening between the billboard and wall and turned to see a man. He was huge and dark, ugly, and he smelled of old wine and vomit and urine with dirt grimed into his face so hard it seemed to crack when he smiled. Yellow teeth, all ugly, and I had fear so that my feet seemed riveted to the ground. Well, he said, his smile widened, fresh young meat. We were from a place where we did not understand such things as this man. Mother had once quietly, simply, told me never to take candy bars from strangers, but had never told me why. It seemed a very silly thing to tell me without a reason. But even with that ignorance, I knew that this man meant me harm, and I grabbed Dog and tried to run past him. It was no good. With one hand, he clawed the back of my shirt and stopped me and lifted me off the ground, so close to his face that I could smell the stink of him even more, and with his other hand, he fumbled with his fly. It's perfect, he said, like Christmas, coming on you this way. Perfect. And I should have run or kicked or screamed or done something, anything, but all I could do was hang there in fear, still holding Dog by one ear, hang like a mouse caught by a cat, waiting for something I couldn't understand to happen. Stunned into shock, waiting, hanging and waiting, and something hit the man so hard in the back of the head that snot sprayed out of his nose. No! My mother's voice exploded in the small area. Only it was more than her voice. There was some wild thing in it, some snarling, ripping thing that made it powerful, all-powerful. And when she hit the man again in the back of his head, he dropped me. Run, she yelled at me. Run for the house. I took her at her word, but I only made the corner. There I stopped because a man and a woman, the people who lived in the apartment across from us, were coming to help. I turned then, knowing I was protected, but if anybody needed help, it was the man. He was on the ground, and Mother was kicking at him. Not with him, you son of a bitch, she screamed. Not with mine, you don't. Goddamn, goddamn, goddamn. And she kept kicking him, even when he was down. Not just wild kicks, but careful ones. She walked around him, waiting until she could find an uncovered spot, and then she would kick, hard and deep, in his groin, his back. And when he would move his hands to protect one area, she'd kick in another. And when at last his hands quit moving and he lay still, she aimed careful kicks at his temples. Aimed perfect, almost dainty kicks with the hard steel toe of her work shoes until he didn't move at all, and I looked up to see her eyes then. There was a great brilliant rawness in them, a wild anger and savagery that made my breath stop, and I felt sorry for the man without really knowing why. He could not win, could not live, could not be while she lived, and she could get to him. The man could not be. It was not that she was killing him, though she was, and not that he was being punished for what he had done or nearly done to me. It was that he could not be, could not exist. In her eyes, in her look, there was no room left for him in all the world. He would end. You bastard, she said in a low voice, almost a hiss, kicking him carefully. He had by this time messed his pants, and the fresh smell of crap and piss filled a small space by the wall. You son of a bitch, not him, not mine you don't, not ever you don't, not ever with mine, you son of a bitch, son of a bitch, son of a bitch. And I think now he was dead. Looking back that he was dead and gone, his head looked soft, pulpy, with spit coming out of his mouth, and the humanness was leaving him. But the couple who'd come to help me took me away then so they couldn't see anymore, took me back to our apartment. A short time later, Mother came back upstairs and sat with me in the kitchen chair next to the table with the oilcloth covered with blue leaves and cleaned her shoes with a damp rag from the sink, her fingers shaking. You must never do that again, she said when she was done. And I cried because of what I had seen, not in the old man and his death, but in her eyes. Cried because it frightened me. And she held me while I cried it out. I was more afraid now than I had been while it was happening. What was that man going to do to me? But she didn't answer. She held me close and rocked back and forth while I cried. And then she made some Ovaltine, and I drank it while she went out in the hall to talk to some police who came to the door.
Writer Gary Paulson, reading from his memoir, Eastern Sun, Winter Moon. We'll hear from a pretty incredible mother after a break. This is Fresh Air. Mothers worry about all the terrible things that can happen to their children. The worst nightmare came true for Dorothy Beam. She lost her only child, Joe, in 1988, when he died of AIDS at the age of 33. At the time of his death, he was working on a sequel to his 1986 book, In the Life, an anthology of black gay writers. The book didn't end with Joe's death. Dorothy Beam decided to finish it with the help of a friend of Joe's. That sequel was called Brother to Brother. In 1992, on Fresh Air, Marty Moss Cohen spoke with Dorothy Beam and asked her how she first learned her son Joe was gay.
Well, it came out at me out of a clear blue sky, to be honest, because we didn't know. I was very naive about gays and lesbians. In fact, I didn't know anything about it. And my son had come in from college, and he said, "Dad, Mom, I want to talk to you." And he said, "Well, I'm gay."
Just as simple as that.
Oh, yeah. He just came right out with it. And well, how can you polish it up? So I was taken aback. But I said to him, "Joe, if you had been a lawyer, I would love you. If you'd have been a doctor, I'd love you." I said, "I'll love you even more that you're gay, because you're going to need a lot of support, an awful lot of support."
And were you concerned about the kind of life that he would have, or the kind of life that he was having?
I was terrified, because I had heard enough to know there was a great deal of gay bashing going on. And I know it's a cruel world out there. And I told him, you know, he's an African male, which is two strikes. Being gay is a triple whammy. That's what I referred to it as, a triple whammy. Not at that time. Later on, I referred to it as a triple whammy. The only thing, after he talked to my husband and I, and he had left the room to go out, my husband didn't feel quite the same way I felt about it. In fact, he still can't accept it. That's why he's not here with me. He doesn't go anywhere with me. And we talked about it. He said that he can't handle it. He can't handle it. And he gives me this story. My father wasn't gay, and my grandfather wasn't gay, and I don't know if anybody in my family was gay. I said, "Well, I don't either. But we have this gay child here. We've got to support him."
Were you literally able to accept it right off the bat? Or was
right
it
off the bat. No. Right. As soon as my son told me, there were no ifs, ands, or but about it, I put my arms around him. I told him it was all right. We would work this thing out together. And whatever he wanted to do, it was all right with me. See, I can't stand around and say to him, "Well, your mother, your father and I got married, and that's the way it's supposed to be." Because when I brought him in the world, I didn't know what he was going to be. I took my chances like everybody else. Just so happens I had a gay son. Yes.
Did you hide the fact at all from your friends and family? Was this an issue that you wanted to keep within your family?
Oh, no. I told everybody that I could think of. I took him everywhere that I ever went. Oh, no, and this is what most people could not understand, my acceptance. They just marveled at it, how I accepted. I said, "What? This is my child. You know, if he was born with one arm, I would accept him. If he was born blind, I would lead him around. This is my son."
You talked about the difficulty of being a gay black man.
Yes.
In this country.
Yes.
What were your then greatest fears for him?
Somebody would hurt him. It bothered me all the time. And I used to say to him, "Joe," when he finally moved from the apartment building in Overbrook, I said, "Joe, be careful how you go out at night. Don't go out alone. Two or three of you go together." Because there was always somebody out to get him. Not just him, any gay or lesbian person. I said, it's better to go to the gay bar. Some of the gay bars, I went with him. I went with him to the gay restaurants. I went with him to the gay bars because I was not ashamed.
And did he like having you there?
Oh, my goodness, yes, yes, yes. I went with him. In fact, a lot of places that I go, and even now, I don't, because I've only been to one since that time to give a girl some information. But they remember me. They said, "Oh, yes, Mrs. Mew, I remember when you used to come with Joe." I said, "Yeah." Well, see, because I wasn't ashamed. So I went with him. When his book came out for his first reading at Giovanni's room, his dad went there. And that's when I found out how his father really felt. Because when we came back that evening, he talked to me about it. He said, "I'm not going through this again." He really.
Is there anything you could say you think to change your husband's mind?
Oh, no, I can't change his mind. In fact, I wouldn't know what to say to change his mind. In fact, he says to me even now, he said, "I don't know how you can go all these places, how you can be a part of all this." He said, "Your son has passed. Let it drop." I said, "I can't let it drop because my son really died for this book. He worked so hard. He put so much into it. This is a legacy to my son. So I'm working every day. Every day I do something."
It's obvious that your life has changed
a
lot.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Since your son died.
Yes.
Do you feel like you really have then embarked on a completely new chapter in your life, or do you feel that you're sort of mixing things from your past and your old life and working them into your new life now?
No, I think that You see, out of everything bad, something good happens. Now, if my son had not passed, I wouldn't even be involved with this. But here I was retiring from school, and see, everything worked out because I had retired from school, and then my son passed, which was a traumatic shock, but God gave me something else to do. So I feel that this is a challenge. This is the way God has prepared for me to go, and I just thank the Lord that my health is getting better, my nerves are calming down, and I can go places and do things. This was what God had prepared for me that I didn't even know about. I did not know I had to rise to the challenge of putting the book out, talking to parents, and helping parents to overcome their, because many of our young people are dying, and parents are trying to cope with that every day. I didn't know I would be a solace or comfort to someone else. I had no idea because I was looking for comfort myself, but now I have to help others.
Are you a different person because of all this?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Yes, I am. I think I'm a much better person.
Do you?
Yes, because I would have never thought of running around like this before to comfort anybody. I would have sent a card. I would have sent maybe flowers. Whatever I could have done, I would have. But I would not have gone to visit, and I wouldn't have called people on the phone and extended myself. And now I extend myself to everyone. Listen, I'd be away somewhere on a cruise, you know, I would be doing something different. Really, I would, you know, I really would not be around, and I would have moved and got myself a condo. I would be living what you call the good life, but the good life is not always the best life. The good life is sometimes a boring life. This is better. I'm helping others.
Do you think that your son had any idea that you actually might be going through his material, his writings? He knew he was dying.
Oh, yes.
You
yes,
didn't
I had
know
that
he was
feeling.
Dying.
Yeah, yeah. I had
but
that,
did,
yeah.
did you think, since he saved everything, that he knew you were going to come and look through his stuff?
Yes, I would imagine. See, I was a teacher, and my son knew that I saved everything, too. I save every bits of paper. Teachers do that. So he would think to himself, if I save everything, I know my mother will go through. She's that kind of a mother, because she wants to know everything that's happening. Yes, he would say, yes, my mother would go through all this. And I told his dad, I said, if Joe is in heaven, and I feel that he is, he's smiling, he's looking down, smiling down, because he says to himself, I knew that my mother would carry on if anything happened to me, because he had that kind of a mother.
Dorothy Beam spoke with Marty Moscowen on Fresh Air in 1992. More about mothers in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air, Mama Tried. It's our Mother's Day show. We'll hear stories about mothers from country music star Merle Haggard, who wrote Mama Tried, Allen Ginsberg, who wrote about his mother in his now famous poem Kaddish, and novelist Amy Tan, who wrote about mothers and daughters in The Joy Luck Club. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Crimson Tide, starring Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton is on his way back to Washington after a week largely devoted to World War II remembrances. This morning he visited a site in Ukraine where thousands of Jews and others were murdered by Nazis. He paid homage to those who died in the massacre at Babi Yar, saying, "We bear witness eternally to the consequences of evil." Later, in a speech at a local university, the president praised Ukraine for its nuclear disarmament.
Ukraine is rising to the historic challenge of its reemergence as a nation on the world stage. Already, your nation can claim responsibility for a major contribution to global peace. Your wise decision to eliminate nuclear weapons on your territory has earned your nation respect and gratitude everywhere in the world.
The crowd cheered when Mr. Clinton told them the United States would help them bear sacrifices as Ukrainians move toward a market economy. Consumer prices rose 0.4% last month. Food prices showed their biggest increase in 5 years. Some of that was the result of severe flooding in California. But the inflation rate for consumers showed widespread price increases. Analyst Nancy Kimmelman says the figures could be an early sign that the Federal Reserve's so-called soft landing may get bumpy.
It's not a bad reading. We're still looking at a modest increase in the rate of inflation. But it is cause for concern. Since the economy still is growing, we'll continue to post positive economic growth in 1995 and probably 1996, meaning that inflationary pressures are probably going to continue to build.
Financial markets were shaken up by the news this morning. Demand for 30-year Treasury bonds fell. 7 people were killed in 2 separate clashes today between Egyptian police and suspected Muslim rebels. NPR Suni Kallan reports from Cairo.
Political violence interrupted the tranquility of the Eid al-Adha religious holiday as anti-government guerrillas fought again with government security forces. The first incident occurred at dawn east of Cairo, where government security forces tried to arrest at least 5 alleged Muslim militants. 3 of the rebels were shot dead on a road as they tried to escape after allegedly lobbing a hand grenade. The second incident occurred at a small village in the troubled Minya province, about 160 miles south of Cairo. A policeman, a suspected militant, and 2 villagers were killed in a shootout. 4 others, including 2 children, were injured. More than 700 people have been killed and 870 others injured since 1992, when the militant Jamaat Islamiyya launched its campaign to topple Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak and install a strict Islamic regime. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today. In preliminary numbers, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 19 points to close at 4,430. It is a 5th straight record close for the blue chip index. This is NPR. The maker of Eskimo Pie ice cream has settled a claim of false advertising with the Federal Trade Commission. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The FTC says Eskimo Pie Corporation falsely advertised its Sugar Freedom line of sandwich bars and scoop desserts as low or significantly reduced in calories, although some contained up to 16 grams total fat, 10 grams saturated fat, and 260 calories per serving. The company has admitted no wrongdoing. A company spokesman says they never intended to give the impression that the product was low in calories. The Trade Commission also alleged that Eskimo Pie's failure to disclose the product's fat and calorie content was deceptive in light of advertising suggesting that the American Diabetic Association had endorsed the desserts. The company says it didn't mean to do so, adding that it has a sponsorship relationship with the association that permits it to use the association logo in some advertising. The proposed settlement would prohibit the company from falsely claiming that any of its frozen desserts have been approved or recommended by any person, group, or organization. Eskimo Pie has agreed to disclose the total fat and saturated fat content of any product that suggests for diabetics. The FTC will take public comment on the proposed settlement for 60 days and then decide whether to make it final. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
The Gulf Coast flood zone is getting more rain, but officials say it's not slowing down the cleanup. Most evacuees in southeastern Louisiana are going home. President Clinton has declared 12 Louisiana parishes federal disaster areas. They now qualify for federal aid. A consumer group and the milk industry agree 2% milk needs to be relabeled. The Center for Science in the Public Interest and the Milk Industry Foundation say milk that's now labeled 2% low fat should be called 2% reduced fat milk. They say skim milk should be renamed fat-free milk. The FDA is checking the request. The two groups say the suggested changes would make the term low-fat have the same meaning as other foods as it should for milk. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
I'm Terry Gross, and on this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're thinking about mothers and Mother's Day. Being a mother can seem like a thankless job if your child is dead set on going astray. Country music star Merle Haggard was one of those kids who went astray. He spent many of his formative years in prison. One of his most famous songs is about his mother. When we spoke earlier this year, we started with Haggard's 1968 recording, Mama Tried.
The first thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind, but Mama tried. One and only rebel child from a family meek and mild, my mama seemed to know what lay in store. In spite of all my Sunday learning, towards the bad I kept on turning, till Mama couldn't hold me anymore. I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried.
Merle Haggard, is this song autobiographical?
Well, it really is very, very close, at least. There's some things we fudged on slightly to make it rhyme, but the majority of it, I'd say 97% of it's pretty accurate, I guess.
Your father died when you were 9, is that right?
9.
So right. Your mother had to raise you alone after that.
Yeah, and I was... to say the least, probably the most incorrigible child you could think of. I was already on the way to prison before I realized it. Actually, I was really kind of a screw up. But I really don't know why. I think it was mostly just out of boredom and lack of a father's attention, I think.
I think you were 14 when your mother put you in a juvenile home.
No, she didn't put me in a juvenile home. The authorities put me in there for truancy, for not going to school, and they gave me 6 months in like a road camp situation, and I ran off from there and stole a car, and then the next time I went back, it was for something serious, and then I spent the next 7 years running off from places. I think I escaped 17 times. I guess I was gathering up meat for songs, you know. I don't know what I was doing. I really kind of was crazy as a kid, and then all of a sudden, you know, and while I was in San Quentin, I just... Uh, I one day understood that I saw the light, and I just didn't want to do that no more. And I realized what a mess I'd made out of my life, and I got out of there and stayed out of there. Never did go back, and went and apologized to all the people I'd wronged, and tried to pay back the people that I'd taken money from, borrowed money from, or whatever. And I think when I was 31 years old, I paid everybody back that I'd ever taken anything from, and including my mother.
What'd you say to your mother when you changed your life around?
Well, it was just obvious. I don't think there was ever any time that anybody in my family was worried about me staying with this. It was just the way that, you know, some people grow up in the Army, and it's hard to be 18 years old, and they send 18 year old boys to war because they don't know what to do with them. And I was one that I wound up going to prison rather than war. And instead of growing up in the middle of a battlefield with bullets flying around me, I grew up on the isolation ward, death row. And that's where the song Mama Tried gets close to being autobiographical.
Merle Haggard recorded earlier this year. Allen Ginsberg talks about a poem inspired by his mother after this break. This is Fresh Air. One of Allen Ginsberg's most famous poems, Kaddish, is dedicated to his late mother, Naomi, who was mentally ill. Allen Ginsberg was one of the most influential beat poets. His poetry then became a part of hippie culture and now is an inspiration to performance poets. We talked about his mother last fall. Your mother was institutionalized several times.
Many, many times, all during my childhood. I had to go out to visit her in Greystone Hospital.
Were you frightened by her madness?
Sometimes sorrowed, sometimes frightened, sometimes stuck with a responsibility I couldn't carry out as a kid, going out alone to see her in a mental hospital when I was 12, 13, 14. Or having to stay home and take care of her while my father was in school teaching, and getting into crisis situations with her that I couldn't handle, actually. It kind of broke my brain in a way, broke my spirit to some extent.
No, when you started doing hallucinogenics, like LSD, did your hallucinations ever scare you because you'd seen your mother have hallucinations and delusions because of her mental illness?
Well, no, not really. I realized that if everybody began disagreeing with me, I better look around twice and think three times and be pretty sure I knew what I was doing. And so I've been able to be in situations where everybody disagreed. But at the same time maintain my sanity, so to speak, by simply following my heart, really. I have as much a tendency to paranoia as anybody in the United States at this point, but at least I can see it's paranoia, and most people don't see their own paranoia.
That's interesting. So your mother's delusions actually helped you figure out what was real and what wasn't?
Well, I went through the, I sort of went through the mill already, so I was kind of inoculated. I would say that the experience of having to deal with somebody who was sort of deluded and hallucinating, also voices and all, helped me deal with my own psychic disturbances and also with the psychic disturbances of other people. I seem to have a kind of tolerance that, you know, in one ear, out the other, or, so that I can be with people who are quite disturbed, get disturbed myself, but not so much so that I have to turn my back until, you know, all hope is lost.
Where were you in your performance style in 1964, the year that the recording of Kaddish was made?
I hadn't ever tried to read anything as long as Kaddish, complete. And so there, and I had drunk a little bit, not very much, so I wasn't really drunk, but I was sort of a little keyed up with alcohol so that I was able to loosen my feelings quite a bit. So the only problem there is maintaining control of feelings and not breaking up and crying. in the middle of more moving passages.
Is there a particular section of Kaddish that you've had the most problem with controlling your emotion?
Yeah, there's a section that begins when I'm visiting my mother in the mental hospital for the last time, and I walk in and I see she's had a stroke. And then there suddenly is a break in the poem, and there's a kind of lyrical rhapsody. Communist beauty, sit here married in the summer among daisies promised. Happiness at hand. To the section that ends, oh, beautiful garble of my karma. It's really a nice, exquisite, poetic passage, but it's also full of feeling, and it's like a flashback in the midst of tragedy to a happier day. And so there's a lot of emotion buried there from childhood. Also, at the very end, the section, oh, mother, what have I left out? Oh, mother, what have I forgotten? With your eyes, with your eyes, with your death full of flowers. That has a sort of cumulative emotional buildup that's quite great.
Why don't I play an excerpt of Kaddish? And you wrote this in the late 1950s. The recording we're going to hear from your new box set was made at Brandeis University in 1964.
With your eyes running naked out of the apartment, screaming into the hall, with your eyes being led away by policemen to an ambulance, with your eyes strapped down on an operating table, with your eyes with a pancreas removed, with your eyes of appendix operation, with your eyes of abortion, with your eyes of ovaries removed, with your eyes of shock, with your eyes of lobotomy, with your eyes of divorce, with your eyes of stroke, with your eyes alone, with your eyes, with your eyes, with your death full of flowers.
That's Allen Ginsberg reading an excerpt of Kaddish. It's included on his new box set, Holy Soul, Jelly Roll. Our interview with Allen Ginsberg was recorded last fall. Amy Tan's bestseller, The Joy Luck Club, juxtaposed the stories of four Chinese women who fled China in the 1940s with the stories of their American-born daughters. The novel is based in part on the life of Tan's mother. In 1989, I talked with Amy Tan about her mother, and she read an excerpt of Joy Luck Club. The main character, June, is an Americanized girl. This reading from the first chapter is after the death of June's mother. Her mother had left two daughters behind in China when she fled, and she was never able to find them again. June has learned those two daughters, her half-sisters, have just been located. Her aunts want her to go to China to meet them and tell them about their mother.
You must see your sisters and tell them about your mother's death, said Auntie Ying. But most important, you must tell them about her life, the mother they did not know, they must now know. See my sisters, tell them about my mother, I say, nodding. What will I say? What can I tell them about my mother? I don't know anything. She was my mother. The aunties are looking at me as if I had become crazy right before their eyes. Not know your own mother, cries Auntie Anmei with disbelief. How can you say? Your mother is in your bones. Tell them stories of your family here, how she became success, offers Auntie Lin. Tell them stories she told you, lessons she taught, what you know about her mind and has become her mind, says Auntie Ying. You mother, very smart lady. I hear more choruses of tell them, as each auntie frantically tries to think what should be passed on. And then it occurs to me, they are frightened. In me, they see their own daughters, just as ignorant, just as unmindful of all the truths and hopes they had brought to America. They see daughters who grow impatient when their mothers talk in Chinese, who think they are stupid when they explain things in fractured English. They see that joy and luck do not mean the same thing to their daughters, that to these closed American-born minds, joy luck is not a word. It does not exist. They see daughters who bear grandchildren, born without any connecting hope passed from generation to generation.
The Joy Luck Club is a series of stories told from the perspective of both the mothers and the daughters. Did you have to learn a lot about your mother and her generation to write this book, things that you didn't know before?
I think that was a discovery when I was writing the book, and in fact, the book was a very personal journey for me. The things that had been in me all my life, I started to discover as I wrote the book. So it was, in a sense, not research and going to books, but research and thinking about the things from my life and then actually talking to my mother about some of the things that I had not thought about in many, many years. You know what this is reminding me of? There's a comment that June's mother makes to her in your novel. The mother says, "You don't even know little percent of me." And that's there's something both very moving and very frightening about that, because it is frightening to think that maybe there really is a whole part of your mother that you know nothing about.
That is actually a direct quote that was said to me by my mother. There was a time when I became, actually when I started to write these stories, I became very frightened one time when she had what seemed to be a heart attack and was hospitalized in intensive care. And she later said to me, when I found that out, I said, "Oh, please, dear God, if she lives, I will find out everything I can about her." And it was recalling something she said to me, which was, "If I die, what would you remember of me?" And then she looked a little sad and said, "I think you would not know anything. I think you know little percent of me." And a lot of the book, the discovery about both my mother and myself, came from that, from a place of fear that I didn't know little percent of my mother.
Has writing this book changed your relationship to your mother?
Well, it was actually during the process of writing it that things changed. And the evidence of that was halfway through I was writing this, my mother was asking me a question, and she said, "Oh, never mind. You understand exactly how I feel." And it made me extremely proud that she felt that way.
Amy Tan recorded in 1989 after the publication of her novel, The Joy Luck Club. We'll have more interviews from our archives next week.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be catching up with Elizabeth Arnold on the very active week that Republicans had both in the House and the Senate. Huge budget-cutting proposals were proposed by majorities in both houses to achieve a balanced budget by the year 2002. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing about Admiral Borda, the new Chief of Naval Operations, and how he is running the Navy in aftermath of the tailhook scandal. And also on today's program, we'll be hearing about the America's Cup race and about transfer students to Washington Irving Elementary in Chicago, the school that Ira Glass has been visiting all year.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Until earlier this year, the producing team of Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer seemed to be out of commission. They had dominated the 80s box office with Flashdance, the Beverly Hills Cop films, and Top Gun, before coming up short with Days of Thunder. But their spring release, Bad Boys, had the biggest opening of the year, and their new movie is directed by the man who made Top Gun, Tony Scott. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Crimson Tide.
There's a lot to be said for the mafia. And certainly South American drug lords have their strong points. That's not to mention high-tech crime gangs led by steely European masterminds. Still, when it comes to giving a movie a really big central threat, there's nothing like the Russian nuclear arsenal. The movies have been missing it since the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and the makers of Crimson Tide must have thanked their lucky stars when Vladimir Zhirinovsky showed up to inspire at least a plausible nuclear danger scenario. In Crimson Tide, a Zhirinovsky-like nutcase has taken command of 60,000 Russian troops and a nuclear base. So the American Navy Captain Ramsey, played by Gene Hackman, is sent off in a fully loaded nuclear submarine toward eastern Russia, just in case a preemptive strike proves necessary. On board with him is his new Harvard-educated executive officer, Ron Hunter, played by Denzel Washington. And right from the start, Hackman's authoritarian bluster and Washington's smooth, slightly insolent elegance seem headed for a collision. The collision comes when the sub receives an emergency message to launch nuclear missiles against the Russian rebels, who are apparently busy arming their own nukes. Ackman decides to go ahead with the nuclear strike, but Washington disagrees.
Captain, I cannot concur.
Repeat my command.
Sir, we don't know what this message means. Our target package could have changed.
You repeat this order, or I'll find somebody who will.
Oh, no, you won't, sir.
You're relieved of your position. Cobb, remove Mr. Hunter from the control room. Get Lieutenant Zimmer in here right now.
No, sir. I do not concur, and I do not recognize your authority to relieve me under command under Navy regulations.
Cobb, arrest this man and get him out of here.
Under operating procedures governing the release of nuclear weapons, we cannot launch our missiles unless both you and I agree.
Cobb, what are you waiting for?
Sir. This is expressly why your command must be repeated. It requires my assent. I do not give it. And furthermore, you continue upon this course and insist upon this launch without confirming this message first, I will be
chief of the boat.
Back by the rules of precedence.
As Captain Commanding Officer.
Of course, we've been in these waters before, not just with submarine movies like The Hunt for Red October, but with the Kane Mutiny and Mutiny on the Bounty. In fact, under Tony Scott's direction, Crimson Tide is the noisiest, most jangling mutiny movie ever made. It's close-ups of scared, sweaty crewmen, and its blue and red color schemes make your retinas twitch. But this is also one of the smartest mutiny movies ever made. And I find it hard to fathom why certain critics have knocked it for what they term its timidity in not going all the way and making Hackman a wild-eyed, militaristic madman. That isn't timidity, that's intelligence. By turning the familiar central conflict into a battle of wills between two attractive and rational men, Tony Scott and the screenwriter Michael Schiffer have raised their movie above the usual hero and villain clichés. And the two lead actors perform a perfect duet, each playing off the energy level of the other, Hackman mixing shrewdness and pride with the fear that every aging lion has of the young upstarts climbing up behind him, and Washington showing how a low simmer can be more forceful than fireworks. The movie's outcome is never in any doubt, of course, and yet Scott and Schiffer manage to build suspense anyway, on movie-making technique alone. For all its expense and hype and star power, Crimson Tide is nothing more or less than a taut and well-made genre picture. And on certain summer weekends, that's exactly what's required.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Today's archive edition of Fresh Air was produced by Fred Landerl and Roberta Sharrock. A few months ago, we said goodbye to an invaluable intern, Sienna Chrisman. Then we had great news that she was coming back to work with us for another semester. Well, that just makes it harder to say goodbye again. We know that she has a bright future ahead, and we wish her good luck. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Knopf, publisher of Spontaneous Healing by Dr. Andrew Weil, a guide to the body's natural healing ways. This is NPR, National Public Radio.